Yes. Yes. Yes, very well. Goodbye.
Ah, my friend. Thank you so much for waiting while I spoke to my associates. Oh, it's better that you don't know. Yes, I asked you here so late because, well, now that the nights have been so much warmer, I felt it might be nice to go for a stroll while I recount some more true tales of Ireland's haunted history. I say again, these are all true tales, which is to say they were all faithfully reported and written down by people who fully believed them. Where shall we go in our little peregrination? Why don't we head away from the crowds and see where our journey takes us? The light will be creeping across the sky before you know it, even at this late stage of the season. So let's make the most of the night while it covers us. Why don't we walk the route along the boardwalk? It's slightly creaking and unsteady, but I'm sure it will hold us for the duration of our stories. Where shall we begin? You know, in times past we might have stumbled across the odd night watchman, hunched up in a poky hut or standing by a brazier on a nocturnal journey such as this. All gone now, of course, but back in 1934, in the city of Waterford, one night watchman had a series of experiences that he carried with him till his dying day. Waterford, if you don't know it, is a charming and historic city in the southeast of Ireland, perhaps a little ramshackle in places, but bearing the mark of the Vikings who founded it, the Normans who conquered it, and the Cromwellians who subjugated it. Reginald's Tower, which is named after the local Viking ruler Reinald, still stands on the quayside. Glance up at the tower and you'll see a cannonball lodged there in its side by Cromwell's forces in 1649. Near the centre of the city, the Polbury Limeworks once stood on what's now a housing development. Back in the day, the man who had the task of watching over the limeworks while the city slept was night watchman Frank Delaney. Described as a man of more than average practical common sense, when Frank wasn't patrolling the grounds, he kept watch from a large hut with a large window. His shift was a long and arduous one, from 5:30 p.m. to 8 a.m. and during it, he was entirely alone. Entirely alone in those limeworks, as the city slept around him. Although perhaps not entirely alone. Because on several occasions, looking through that big square window in the dead of night, as the hour ticked towards midnight, Frank saw an image form on the other side. Alone in the limeworks, he found himself looking at a translucent mist which gradually took the form of a human face. Night after night, the face grew clearer and clearer each time it formed in the air. I say the face was human, but that's not quite how Frank described it. He said it had the shape of a human face, but also a spiritual aspect, which took it beyond the realms of the merely flesh and blood. Well, at first, Frank, a deeply stoical man, clearly was more intrigued than alarmed. But as the manifestations continued, night after night after night, that same human face forming in the mist, floating before the window night after night, well, Frank became more troubled. To protect himself, for by now he must have felt in need of protection, Frank did what any moderately pious Catholic man might have done in that day and age. He got hold of a good supply of holy water, and he sprinkled it over the windows. If he was hoping that this would ward off the apparition, he was wrong. Instead, the effect of the holy water seemed to draw the face closer, closer to the window, closer to Frank. Well, word traveled fast in those days, and these uninvited midnight visits sent a chill through the entire city. Children lived in dread of pulling back their bedroom curtains, if they had them, for fear of what might be on the other side. One suspects that more than a few adults secretly harbored the same fear. As was often the case with Irish hauntings in these days, local youths ganged together to tackle the spectre head on, a group of young men, doubtless feeling a lot safer in one another's company, stood vigil outside the limework gates all night. The apparition never materialized, and at this point, it vanishes from the historical record. So what can we conclude? That Mr. Delaney made it all up to liven the long stretches of monotony in his little watchman's hut? Hardly. We've all heard tall tales. Some of us have told a few of them. But surely Frank would have pulled the plug on this one before it got his name into the local paper, inviting ridicule from his workmates and neighbours. No. What else? Well, limeworks are quite hazardous places. The kilns often burn overnight, and the smoke can be toxic, so perhaps after long hours wandering the premises late at night, it all began to go to Frank's head. Or perhaps more likely, some combination of the smoke and the mists and fogs of a maritime city blended together, forming patterns in Frank's weary mind. Patterns that began to look like the very thing he yearned for and the very thing he dreaded seeing alone in the dead of night. Another human face. But why then was he so specific about the look, the aspect, the character of that face? Perhaps it could happen to anyone. Perhaps when you return to your safe home and pull open the curtain, the face that stares back might not be your own dim reflection. Where are we now? I'm afraid I've rather lost my way. Shall we step into this cafe for a cup of tea? Strange to see one open at this hour. Gentleman behind the counter has such an unearthly aspect. Well, he appears solid enough anyway. Two teas, please. Surly enough, too. You know, it's a thing that can get you into a lot of trouble, being too twitchy about the supernatural. Actually, back in 1930, in Dara, County Cavan. Time and again we're drawn to County Cavan, although in fact half of the village is in County Leitrim. Dara is a small village near the source of the mighty Shannon. In the hinterland of the village is a place called Glengevlin, and it was there in the early part of the 20th century that a woman named McGrath lived. Now, Glengevlin is an ancient place. Legends echo through its hills and valleys, such as the magic cow that never ran out of milk and nourished half of Ulster. Llangefnan people were deeply proud of their village, Glan they call it, as one wrote in a poem in tribute to his deceased brother about this time. Before my mind are crowding now, fond memories of Glan, the winding roads, hills and dales, in visions bright I scan. O God be with you, Moaning dear, the place from whence we came, where neighbours live in peace and love, and God supreme does reign. Well, as for neighbours living in peace and love, we shall see about that. Back to Mrs. McGrath. At the age of 76, the widow McGrath passed away, and her house, little by little, as all earthly things must, fell into ruin. One night, two brothers, Barney and Michael McGrath, undoubtedly relatives of the late Mrs. McGrath, were passing by the ruins of her home when they saw a figure blocking their passage. It was the figure of an old lady in a black dress, black veil, and an old-fashioned black cap. It was a figure they knew, because it was, surely, the figure of the late Mrs. McGrath herself. Now, there had been rumours of strange goings-on at the McGrath house, of lights in the night where no lights should be, even rumours of Mrs. McGrath's ghost walking abroad after dark. And so the two lads were instantly struck with fear. Michael in particular, because, well, he had been frightened of Mrs. McGrath in life, let alone in afterlife, and was also, as he put it, a cripple and unable to run as the fear seized him. "What is that?" Michael whispered to Barney. "Something horrid," Barney replied. But taking up the initiative, plucking up his courage, Barney approached the ghost of Mrs. McGrath. He leaned in towards her and asked her what she wanted. Her response stunned him in every sense, for she reached into the folds of her dress, produced an iron bar, and struck him hard on the side of the head. Well, at least that's how the brothers McGrath told it. The ghost, for her part, had a very different story, for she was, in fact, the very much alive Mrs. Catherine McGovern. You see, the McGoverns and the McGraths had been feuding in Derry Nananta for generations. For all I know, they may still be feuding. And Mrs. McGovern gave a very different version of events when the case came to Dara District Court in March 1930. She and her husband, it seems, had been searching for a stray donkey, a search which took her onto the late Mrs. McGrath's farmland, when the McGrath brothers crossed her path and demanded to see what she was hiding under her coat. She refused and defended herself with a stick, not an arm bar, while the brothers pelted her with stones until her husband arrived and broke up the contretemps. Mrs. McGovern, who insisted, contrary to local rumour, that she was not in the habit of dressing up as Mrs. McGrath and imitating her ghost, brought a summons against the two brothers for assault and abusive language, while Barney brought a cross case against her that, as the summons put it, and this is possibly the most remarkable summons ever issued in an Irish court, that the defendant did, when under disguise as an unliving spirit, unlawfully assault and beat the complainant by striking him with an iron bar on the side of the head. It all caused much hilarity in the district court, but at the heel of the hunt, Mr. Rice found for the alleged ghost and fined the McGrath brothers a shilling each, with £1 for costs and £1 for expenses. Speaking of which, let's pay and press on, shall we? Oh, he seems to have abandoned his post. Well, this seems about right for two teas, wouldn't you say? Back in the cool night air, at last. Do you find the nights are freshening up a touch? You know, summer's lease really hath all too short a date, as a man once wrote. For our next story, let's step across to Clonus, County Monaghan. Is story the word? Perhaps a legend might be the most used, because this tale has roots that stretch back at least a century. Clonus has always had the reputation of being a haunted place. From 1842 until 1921, the Clonus Poor Law Union Workhouse stood, or rather loomed, in the south of this border town. The workhouse was, to be frank, an appalling place, designed to accommodate the destitute and the poorest of the poor, without humanity, without dignity, without pity. In the spring of 1905, the workhouse added another terror to the list. Two homeless gentlemen, and the papers call them tramps, had been admitted to the casual ward of the workhouse. Casual as in temporary, they weren't residents, but they were spending the night there. Around 10:30 at night, these two unfortunates awoke to find the figure of a tall man walking up the stairs in the moonlight. A tall man who pulled the bedding from under them and began to hurl the bedclothes around the room. They had absolutely no doubt that this figure was not of this world. Their screams aroused the porter, Mr. Gunn, who unlocked the door, at which point the two terrified men ran past him onto the landing, without even pausing to dress. Gunn was adamant. The door to the casual ward had been securely locked. Indeed, he'd had to unlock it to let the two frantic men escape. There was no other entrance. Nobody, at least nobody bound by the conventional laws of physics, could have walked into that room that night. Well, few people pay heed to the fears of those we're told to look down upon, then or now. But Gunn, the porter, was convinced that the two men had experienced something truly terrifying within those forbidding limestone walls. The local papers, and indeed the guardians of the workhouse, found it all most amusing, and they welcomed anything that discouraged what they called tramps from seeking the dubious refuge of the workhouse. All the same, a few months later, it happened once more. A man named Johnson from Ballybay was staying in the casual ward when, in the dead of night, another man entered, calmly unfolded a bed, and settled down. Not being in a sociable mood for obvious reasons, Johnson ignored his new companion and drifted off to whatever sleep he could find in that dreadful place. In the morning, Johnson awoke to find himself alone. He sought out the porter, Mr. Gunn, who told him that no one else had entered the ward in the night, and that the door had remained steadfastly locked all night. The master of the workhouse, Mr. Joseph McKenna, ordered a full investigation, but no explanation was ever found. Though, decades later, an explanation was proffered in the local press. Namely, that the ghost had been none other than Mr. McKenna himself. You see, as bad as Clonus Workhouse was, it was still, so the theory goes, superior to the other miserable refuges of the destitute in the region, and so it became the first port of call for those desperate enough to seek out its shelter. McKenna, seeking to thin the population and give himself an easier life, staged the ghost panic, playing the part of the ghost himself, to make potential residents think twice before entering. Well, so the theory goes. If it was indeed a trick, it was a cruel one. Clonus Workhouse was mercifully closed down in 1921 with the coming of the new Irish Free State. But I want you to remember about the tall man who appeared unbidden in the dead of night in Clonus. Because we might just be returning to him, or him to us, soon. 1937. Drumully, near Clonus, surrounded on all sides by County Fermanagh and the new Northern Ireland. The only route back to the Free State is across running water. So often these borderlands, these suspended places, seem to host the frontiers of our perception. It's Friday night, 10th of September. A young woman aged 20 is clinging on to the last shreds of summer. She's just coming back from a ceilidh, a traditional country dance, at a nearby farmhouse. Her young heart is light and gay, her feet still skipping to the memory of jigs and reels. Oh, for sure, she knew about the local legend told in this corner of Monaghan, about the figure so often seen here among the dense hedgerows beside this stretch of the Ulster Canal. But cloaked in youthful joy, such things were far from her mind on that early autumn night in 1937. Until, well, I'll let her take up the story. I was walking along the road without the least fear or thought of the ghosts, which I have often heard of but never believed in, when a sudden chill of fear came over me and I found myself growing numb from head to foot. This was at Drumsloe, where the canal crosses the road. Then, like a flash, an apparition of a lady in white crossed the road about a yard in front of me. I saw her young, beautiful face, which was lit up with a happy, expectant look as it disappeared through the Whitehorn hedge by the roadside. I couldn't go a step further, and the last thing I remember was running back to Mrs. Murta's, where I collapsed on the floor. For their part, Mr. and Mrs. Murta corroborated the young lady's story and said they'd brought her round and escorted her home. Mr. Murta remembered hearing the story of the lady in white from old-timers in his youth, which, given his age, must have dated back to the 18th century. In fact, Mr. Murta was able to put a precise date on the haunting. Back in 1777, he said, the daughter of a yeoman of the guard fell in love with a British army officer, and they would meet for secret trysts by the canal at Drumsloe. It was a harsh winter, and in December, the waters froze over. Alas, they didn't freeze hard enough. Our fair young maid, skipping across the canal to her assignation with her one true love, fell through the cracking ice and was drowned in the canal. And from that day forth, her spirit had haunted that spot in futile search of her lost love.
Well, so said Mr. Myrtle. It's a good story, but a little too convenient. For one thing, the canal wasn't even built until almost 50 years after the lady is said to have drowned in it. But it's always comforting, isn't it, to pin a name and a date to a ghost, if only so we know what we're dealing with. After all, if the young lady in white who haunts the canal road at Drumslow is not the forlorn young lover of 1777, then who is she? What does she actually want? And what might she do to get it? The years roll on. The stage is struck and redressed, and upon this restless orb is no thing forever fixed. It's the autumn of 1975 now, and another young girl, 18-year-old Patricia Slowey, is returning home from a friend's house in Clonus, along with her sister, Bernie. They know the Scarver Road has an eerie reputation, and the hour being late, nearly 1 o'clock in the morning, the girls are a little uneasy, but they're close to home and looking forward to a cup of tea and a warm bed. But then, well, as Patricia told it herself, there is a clump of bushes near the sharp bend in the road, and I saw what appeared to be a large shadow standing between two of the bushes, and it seemed to be carrying a light under its left arm. The sisters grabbed each other tight, and Patricia clutched the crucifix that hung around her neck. But the figure kept following them along the moonlit path, keeping pace until they reached their own gate. The two girls rushed through their front door in terror, too terrified even to wake their sleeping parents. Patricia was still recovering from the shock when, a few weeks later, the presence made itself known once more. Patricia was being driven home by her brother, Paddy, when, peering through the pouring rain, she caught sight of a tall man standing in the road. Looking closer, she noticed that the man was carrying a light under his arm. When Patricia pointed him out to Paddy, the man disappeared. Well, Patricia had no doubt that this apparition was not of this earth. In fact, she had a mass said on its behalf, just in case it was a trapped soul reaching out across the veil for peace or redemption. In those days, the Scarborough Road was also home to members of the travelling community who pitched their tents and caravans along the road. The most prominent member of this community was a man named Big Tom Maughan. Now, this was no idle nickname. Big Tom, a father of 13, was an enormous man, a man who had once lifted a 40-stone JCB bucket for a £1 bet. So when Big Tom became so spooked that he packed up his tents and moved his family to another site, you can be sure that whatever was lurking on that roadside was a thing of terror. Big Tom had seen the ghost himself. Where others had described a light tucked under its arm, Big Tom felt it was more like a white handkerchief. Tom's neighbours, the Cawleys, had led the exodus from the camp. Peter Cawley and his wife had left their children in the tent, safe among their neighbours, while the couple went to the pictures. Or so they thought. They returned to find the children talking about a strange man, a tall man, who had walked into the tent and sat himself down by the fire. In any case, by the time the man from the Northern Standard newspaper came back to the site of the haunting, Tom was re-erecting his tent on the Scarver Road, a little sheepish at having fled from the ghost given his fearsome reputation. But it was quite clear to the man from the Standard that Tom's wife, and indeed his fearsome Jerseyman Shepherd dog, were still utterly terrified by that place. Now, as with any haunting, if the spectre sticks around long enough, someone comes forward with an explanation for its presence, and in Clonus, that someone was Mr. Harford Fitzgerald. Harford was the last of the Clonus Fitzgeralds, descended from one of the most renowned families in Irish history, and the family mansion, Clonavilla House, had been burned to the ground by its new owner just before this latest manifestation of the tall man's ghost. But Harford believed the ghost had an earlier origin, dating back to the murder of a man named Little in the early years of the 20th century. It seems this Little was beaten to death by locals over some personal dispute. A wall of silence closed around the killers, and no one was ever charged. Since then, the tall man had walked the Scarver Road and had been terrifying visitors for as long as Harford could remember, and he was not a young man in 1975. Whether the tall man of Clonus was the vengeful ghost of the murdered Little, some were determined to unmask it. Local engineer and photographer Donal McEnroe rounded up a posse to go ghost hunting along the Scarver Road. "My view," he said, "is that these things are more felt than seen. A few of my friends are keen to see the ghost, and perhaps I could get a photograph of it." Sadly, among the incredible collection of 4,500 photographs of Monaghan life that Donal left to the County Museum, there is none featuring the tall man Clonus. It is to be assumed that whether seeking vengeance or redemption or some motive beyond our understanding, that he still roams the loneliest stretches of the Scarver Road today, light tucked under his arm, casting the longest of shadows at midnight. You always know you've gone too far when you hear the sound of running water. Come, let's turn back towards civilization before the night flees before us. And while we do, let me tell you the story of the Coolara Peninsula in the northwest of County Sligo. Coolara is a truly ancient landscape. Some of its burial mounds have held the remains of its earliest inhabitants for over 6,000 years. There's a story that's told in Coolara that is perhaps closer in tone to a legend than to the tales that we normally share. It's perhaps more of a folk tale than a ghost story, but it is told in earnest in that part of the world, and that is how I shall tell it to you. Once upon a time, yes, why not? Once upon a time, there lived in Coolara a man named Red O'Neill. One night, and it was a calm, warm summer's night, a night much like tonight, Red, as was his wont, decided to take a solitary stroll through the fields while his wife stayed behind. Well, not quite solitary, because Red brought with him his two dogs. Well, his own dog, and a stray that had wandered into the house some days earlier and made itself at home. This happy band made their way by two legs and four to a field known locally as the Four Winds, where they hopped over a low stone wall, the kind that parcels up the Irish countryside into farmers' petty kingdoms. Suddenly, The stray let out a horrendous screech. Red turned sharply and told it to shut up, but this only made the stray louder and angrier and more bestial. Its howls became so terrible that Red's own dog, abandoning its owner and with a strange red glow in its eyes, scurried away and cowered in a corner of the field. Red turned back to look at the stray, but it wasn't there anymore. What was there? In its place, bathed in a beam of light, was a man. Not a dog, but a man. A man dressed all in white and with gleaming red eyes. And upon the man's cloak were two black spots, just like those on the cloak of the stray dog. The man in the white cloak turned away from Red and walked slowly towards the sacred hill of Knocknaree, and then simply disappeared. And when Red ran towards the spot from which the man had vanished, he found nothing except the paw prints of a dog. Back at home that evening, Red mulled whether to tell the story to his wife, who could tell he was out of sorts. Just as he began to relate his strange experience, into the living room padded Red's dog and the white stray. Red stared at it in disbelief and stammered to his wife that he had seen the dog, that same stray dog, transform into a man and disappear. But Red, said his wife, that dog didn't stir from the house all day. It was here the whole time you were on your walk. And that is the story of Red O'Neill and the Dogman of Coolera, and whether the dog stayed with him and whether it ever transformed again, and whether Red stopped walking the hillside at night. Well, those are things we shall never know. But we do know that that story, or a story like it, is found in almost every corner of Ireland and has been told in variations for as long as anyone can remember. Because stories like that never truly come to an end. They swirl around the ether, gathering new names, new locations, new details. But even when the last bearer of the tale has been buried and forgotten, the story remains out there somewhere, looking for a new vessel to give it life once more. And now, my friend, you are that vessel. Well now, the fog has lifted, and here we are again. In a few moments, the streetlights will wink out, the traffic will begin to roar, and the shades of night will fade once more. Until tomorrow night, and until next we meet, farewell.